This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Donnell Butler. Donnell is the Pahara Aspen Educational Fellow and the Senior Associate Dean for Planning and Analysis of Student Outcomes at Franklin and Marshall College. And I didn't say he is a sociology degree. Donnell, degree holder. Donnell, who did you study under at Princeton?
Marta Tienda, Tom Espenshade, and the amazing Doug Massey.
Nice committee.
But I had so many teachers other than them. I mean, Marv Breslin, the living legend, who's no longer living, but was a legend when he was. And Viviana Zelizer, who oversaw pretty much my development as an economic sociologist, which is what I thought I was going to be until I, you know, switched to my dissertation topic. Oh, there were so many great people I learned from. Alejandro Portes, Scott Lynch was sort of my second reader, not really on my committee. But man, I would spend hours with Scott Lynch, you know, talking about data stuff.
Scott's a brilliant guy, and Viviana is also salt of the earth, just like Frank.
Yes.
Well, so anyhow, we're really glad to have you on because, you know, you've taken a different path. And I actually remember you always wanting to take a different path. Even back in the day, you had your sights set on admin and sort of the executive track. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your path from a sociology PhD to the executive track. Like, what is it? How do you do it? Who's it good for? What does it take to make it on that track?
When I talk to students who are thinking about getting a PhD, but they're not sure if they want to be a professor, I go, that's fine. Just don't tell them that. It's okay to take what you're going to learn in a PhD program and use it for other purposes. For me, my actual original goal was I wanted to be able to merge the sociological toolkit with the toolkit from what I would describe as the accounting, auditing, and business consulting world. I essentially want to be a consultant for nonprofits, for educational institutions, for health and behavioral welfare organizations. And so my plan was to take both my business background and my social background and basically become the McKinsey for nonprofits. What detoured me along the way was I kind of fell in love with research. I liked teaching, but I didn't love it enough. And what I really loved was the research. And I learned as a graduate student, I couldn't do both at the same time. So every semester that I taught as a teaching assistant, you know, I worked with Howard Taylor one semester, Patricia Fernandez Kelly once. Like with any semester that I was a teaching assistant, I got no research done. None, because I was all into the teaching. I like consumed every one of the readings. I sitting with the professor trying to understand how they design their lecture. Like I was all in to be like, one day I'm going to be a great professor, but I got no research done. And everything everybody told me was, well, you have to do both teaching and research. And I was like, I can't choose. And not only did I not want to choose, in my heart of hearts, I like putting things into practice. And there was no way to do that. Like that wasn't part of the process. The process of getting tenure was, you know, good research, good teaching. There was nothing about helping make schools better or helping develop programs or evaluating existing interventions. That wasn't part of the process.
So let me ask you a follow-up on that. You know, we know some people, a lot of people who listen to this are graduate students. Maybe some of them are contemplating this career path. Can you tell us who is this line of work good for? What do you need to succeed in this line of work? And what's the first step? If you have a PhD student who is interested in getting on the executive track, what would you recommend to them?
Well, I'd say the first thing they need to think about is there a particular reason why they want to be in a sort of non-academic job? Right. What's your rationale for wanting to be in a non-academic job? I would say that for some folks, it's probably not the wisest thing to do if you just don't think or you're having a hard time finding a job, right? Because the job market's tough, right? Mm-hmm. But if you try to sell yourself in the non-academic job market, just as, well, I have a PhD, hire me, that's not going to work, right? You need to be able to make a connection between skills that you're developing in your PhD program with whatever that organization or industry needs. And so part of that is figuring out, well, what are you passionate about? What are your long-term goals? What matters to you that's outside of academia? And there's clearly something. You just have to identify what it is. Then once you've done that part, once you've basically got, what is my hook? What is the thing that's going to drive me outside of academia? Then you just start researching, you know, and you've got the research skills.
So I have a question that's totally unrelated to the last question, but I think it's actually allows me to ask you about where you are right now. And I hope that this question will allow you to use all of the different hats you have, like as a sociologist, right? And also as an administrator, right? And this has to do with how colleges and universities across the country have been wrestling with free speech, and thinking about, trying to balance free speech on the one hand and things like anti-harassment policy on the other, free speech on one hand and, you know, and students feeling safe on the other. For whatever reason, I still keep getting emails from the University of Michigan where I did my postdoc, and it looks like Richard Spencer is supposed to be speaking there. And we know what happened, you know, down in Florida where he last spoke, at least to my knowledge. And so what are your insights about this, Danelle?
How are we defining free speech? Because what I've seen far too often is this initial notion that, well, freedom of speech is in the Constitution. Okay, well, if we're going to use that argument, the Constitution is about the government, right? It's not about private institutions, right? Colleges and universities can do whatever they want to. Well, not whatever they want to, but college and universities have a lot more room to move.
Well, the private ones anyway.
What about a public school, though, like University of California or CUNY?
Well, even they have some room to move in a different way, because it really says, so, you know, and you may want to edit this, but I'm gonna pull up the Constitution right now.
All right.
First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Congress shall make no law. Free speech is about, in the First Amendment, free speech is about Congress, what Congress can do and what Congress cannot do. It's not about what colleges and universities can and cannot do. So when we're really talking about free speech, what we're talking about oftentimes at colleges and universities is the ability to have a conversation about any topic at any time with the goal of understanding more. This is where I have a problem sometimes, though, with certain types of speakers that are brought to campus and certain types of comments that sometimes you will hear students say when they are attacking other students, is that you're not trying to understand in some cases, you're trying to provocate. You're trying to start something, right? And there's a difference between raising a topic, raising a discussion that's controversial or provocative for the purposes of trying to understand, for the purposes of trying to reach common ground. But if your goal is simply to attack, demean, provocate to anger, provocate to violence, if your goal is just to basically have a platform to say what you want to say for your own purposes, and you really don't care if anything of value comes out of it other than it pumps your ego up and that of what you believe, I think that's just a waste of time. Hmm. I think colleges and universities have a stand that they need to take. And the stand they need to take is, we're all about free speech that's all about understanding. All the other forms of speech, we're not about. There's no value to it.
Well, let me try to, first of all, if you don't know, Gabriel had to leave quickly, but I want to channel Gabriel here, something that he said a few episodes ago about when we were talking about somebody trolling on Twitter. I forget who it was, but his position was he doesn't want to be put in a position where he has to judge the merit or quality of someone's speech. He'd rather just have everybody be allowed to speak, so that the idea is that if you protect all forms of speech, it will sort of give a very strong protection to high value speech, and the price that we have to tolerate is low value speech. What's your reaction to that?
So as an administrator, there's a simple solution to that. If Richard Spencer wants to come and talk, cool. Richard Spencer can come and talk. But he doesn't get to just come and talk in a lecture hall by himself for 50 minutes. He's got to be on a panel. And he's got to be on a panel with some other voices that can be representing other points of view. So that it's not about judgment here. It's about, we're trying to get to dialogue. We're trying to get to an understanding here. That doesn't happen if it's just Richard Spencer getting the microphone for 40 to 50 minutes.
Yeah, the other thing that I would say is, you know, like how much did they pay in Florida to prepare for him to come because of safety concerns? Or was it $600,000? Do you know how many students you could have given a free ride for a year?
That's a lot of tuition.
And for what? Right? For what? I mean, I understand the whole point of saying, okay, I don't want to be the one to judge, you know, this person's speech versus another. But let me tell you this, I think I'm very comfortable judging, like feeling like I can judge, doing a cost-benefit analysis and saying, is having one person come and speak here worth $600,000 for our institution? And I mean, would you give somebody a speaker fee of $600,000? Probably not. So I don't know.
That sounds like a lot, 600 grand. Is that really how much it cost?
Well, that's how much it costs because of all the safety concerns.
Right. The lowest estimate I've seen is 500,000. So 600,000 could be right. But I've seen the estimate as low as 500,000. Either way, that's way too much money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a very expensive.
I don't think Obama gets that much money, does he?
Oh, I'm sure he does.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of The Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.